Hi everyone, it's March 25th, 2024. For some of you, maybe still Shushan Purim. Rabbi Kelman is going to be a little late, so I will get started. We're now in part three of the Mussar dispute. Let me just, in no particular order, pick up on some things that were said last time. One of the last things we saw is that Rabbi Kelman mentioned this idea of Rav Soloveitchik, how Chazar, he doesn't like singing and Chazaras HaShatz, things like that. That plays into this idea of the Rav that, or is related to this idea that Chazaras HaShatz is not something that we just do, it used to be motzi people who couldn't daven, but, and it's sort of, we continue doing it. But no, there's independent value. There's like a kiyum. That's why if you notice, real talmidim of the Rav would stand with their feet together, like they were in their own Shemona Esrei. So I was thinking, and I wonder if anyone, a student of the Rav, knows the answer to this. Where generally we don't correct people if they make a mistake in repetition of Shemona Esrei. If someone repeating Shemona Esrei pronounces a word incorrectly, we don't correct them. Because, like I said, we're not, if you look in the show, we're really not being motzi anyone. I wonder if the Rav held that you should correct someone if he mispronounces a word or skips a word or something. We don't correct people if they skip a word by mistake. I wonder if the Rav, it seems to me that the Rav should require correcting people for that. A number of people wrote to me about, this little dispute we had. I called the Radbaz, David Ibn Zimra, the last of the Rishonim. And some people said, well, maybe he should be one of the Achronim. He's born in 1479. He actually dies right around the same time as Rav Yosef Karo. Normally, we think of Rav Yosef Karo as, I don't know, Rav Yosef Karo, I don't think of him as a Rishon or an Achron. He's sort of in the middle. So being that the Radbaz is before, I thought of him as like a late Achron. Really, he died still the same time as the Marshal, Shlomo Lauria, Rav Yosef Karo. We don't consider them Rishonim, so maybe he's not one of the Rishonim. I really think it's pretty more of a semantic dispute. I don't know, because even if he is one of the Rishonim, he's not in the same level as the Rambam. Thank you for Michael, for pointing out, though, that others, Dinari in particular, has said that the Black Death, that's where we should make the distinction. But he says that Art Scrolls says that the Shulchan Aruch is the end of the Rishonim. So, okay. So I don't know if this really has any practical implications. We did speak about last class standing up for Aseret HaDibros. And Jacob said that Sfaradim don't stand up. And I said, because of the Ari. And I said, as far as I know, the Ari never says anything about this matter. I mean, I've read Rav Avadia's Tshuva, I read others. And I misunderstood what Jacob was saying. I thought he was saying that the That just like the Rambam says not to stand up because you don't want to imply that something is, has more sanctity. That's how I understand the Rambam, by the way. If you just read the Rambam, you could very easily understand it to mean that the Rambam saying that we don't want to show that any psukim have more importance. But I don't think that's what he means. Because if you look in his introduction, if you look in the 13 principles in the Parashah Mishnah, the way he describes the psukim, he makes it clear that all psukim have equal sanctity. And I don't think it makes sense to say that all psukim are of equal importance because the Rambam himself lets us know that some psukim are of more importance. But in any event, I didn't know the Ari said anything about that. Afterwards, what I found, and this is what Jacob had in mind, was that the Ari says you're never supposed to stand. It has nothing to do with the Aseret HaDibros or not. That's just al pi ha-Kabbalah. According to the Ari, you're always supposed to sit. But there are those who say they make an exception. So, for instance, here's an interesting exception I found just by looking at this. Rav Yaakov Yisrael Al-Ghazi. He was, here, I'll pull up, hold on a second. Where is it? Let's see, Rabbi Al-Ghazi. I gotta pull up my page here, so you can see if people want to go later. Ah, here. I found it here from the early, from the mid 18th century. He was the Rishon LeZion in Yerushalayim from Smyrna. He wrote a sefer. It's the first one at the bottom you see here called Shalmei Tzibur. Well, if you look in Shalmei Tzibur, actually the section, really it's in the second section, which is called Shalmei Chagiga. If you look on page Resh Sadi, he speaks about, first of all, he says that when we read Aseres Adibros, he quotes an earlier authority. He says that it's, we read it with neginos, special singing, and this applies both on Shabbos and on Shavuos. And then he says, in section Yud Gimel, he quotes another source, Chet Yud. I have to look up who Chet Yud is, that when we recite it, everyone should be be'ema v'yira. They should have great fear and in awe. When we read the Aseres Adibros, just like Maimon Har Sinai. And he says, even though Harav Zal, that's referring to the Ari, says that you're not supposed to stand in Kriyas HaTorah, he says, for this Kriyas HaTorah, Aseres Adibros, you are supposed to stand just like they stood at Har Sinai. And then he says, and this is something I don't know if anyone does it today in the Sephardic world, he says, the Haftarah of Shavuos. It's a Haftarah, it's Ma'aseh Merkava of Yechezkel. He says you're supposed to also stand for that as well, because it's such an important matter. It's, and it's also, it's the, he says, Dugma Har Sinai. Furthermore, he says that this Haftarah is special. You're not supposed to have a katan read it. Normally you can. So thank you, Yaakov, for pointing that out. I'll just add, though, there are many Sephardim who do stand for Aseres Adibros. Practice in Morocco is to stand. If you look in your Shem Tov, Gagin, I think you pronounce it Gagin. I don't know how they pronounce it in England. In Hebrew, it's written as Gagin, but it's spelled with Gagune. So Gagin, maybe is how you pronounce it. But he was the Chacham of the London Sephardic community. He wrote a multi-volume work called Keter Shem Tov, which has minhagim from all over. And he tells us that the minhag in Amsterdam and in London is to stand among the Sephardim. So you have many places where the minhag is to stand in, among the Sephardim. And as for the Ashkenazim, let me introduce you to a figure whose name is similar to a name we're gonna hear about, but he's in America. Where is he? Here he is. Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Grudzinski, a cousin of the famous Reb Chaim Ozer, but he comes to Omaha, Nebraska in 1891. Omaha, Nebraska. My step-grandfather moved to Omaha, Nebraska when he came in the first part of the 20th century. He was the rabbinate there, 1891. So he probably was the biggest Talmud Chacham in America at that time. And he wrote a number of Sfarim. You can see a, oops, where is it? Nope. I don't see it here. But you have a, there's a Kvarim. The site kvarim.com or .net has information about him. Here's, he has two Kvar. He has a Kever. He has a Matseva. This isn't a Matseva. This is on the ground behind, I think, or in front. I don't know where it is, because I'll tell you why I don't know where it is. Because when I went to Omaha, Nebraska a number of years ago, let me show you this. So what did the rabbi do? He, of course, he took me to see Hirsch Grudzinski's grave. And there it is. All it says is Grudzinski, but on the ground, maybe in front where the snow is or behind, that's where you have the names that I showed you again. Here, I'll show you again. This is on the ground, which I never saw this. Rav Gonsara Torah. Dies in 19, it's, I guess 48 January, maybe the end of December, 47. Well, they, in addition to his Sfarim, the journal Yeshurin, volume 2, published some other stuff from him, and he says as follows. You can find it on page 203. He says, Bechol hamakomos hagdolim be'Europa. He says, in all the great places in Europe, kemo ir va'im be'Yisrael Vilna, Kovno, remember, Kovno, we saw that Rav Leibel Shapiro, he tried to stop people from standing. But he says, nevertheless, in Vilna, in Kovno, this is a letter for, he wrote in 1947. He's talking about when he was living there. which was before 1891, Navardic, which is where he's from, V'chein b'shar makomos b'lita v'zamut, and all the rest of the places in Lita, Zamut is what? That's the northwestern part, and all of Lita. He says that Ra'isi shemin agam la'amod kol atzibur b'shas kriyas aseres adibros. So we see that the universal minhag, he testifies, was in Lita, was to stand. And finally, as we were ending, a number of you added some questions into the chat. I didn't want to take too long, so I copied them. And let me respond to one of them, and that's Chaim. Chaim Hecht, you wrote, well, I mentioned the Rubinstein affair. Remember where Rabbi Yitzhak Rubinstein became the rabbi? He was actually the crown rabbi already. Earlier, 1910, I believe it was, there was an election between him and Rav Tzair, Chaim Chernovitz, and everyone, including Chaim Ozer among the Orthodox, supported Rubinstein. And then we spoke about how after World War I, because he stayed and helped the people during the war, there was a lot of support for him. We dealt with that, and anyone who's interested can see. I think I pulled it up here. Hold on. My screen here. I don't have it, I think. Oh, no, I do have it. Okay. Well, I don't need to show it to you, but there's two articles by Gershon Bacon dealing with the rabbinical dispute in Vilna, the election, and the controversy between Rabbi Rubinstein or Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. Now, Chaim said that I said since the Vilna Gaon, there was no rabbi in Vilna. And then you point out the fact. So if I said that, I misspoke. I meant since the times of the Vilna Gaon, there was no rabbi in Vilna. There was a Rav in Vilna, and the Rav in Vilna was this individual. Where is he? Shmuel ben Avigdor. And you can read, there's actually a very nice Hebrew article in Wikipedia. The English article is not so complete, but there's been a lot written on it. And the Vilna Gaon opposed Shmuel ben Avigdor, but he had the support of many in the community, including the Hasidim or the proto-Hasidim, even though later he would sign the Cherem against them. So after his period, until the Polish government was in control of Vilna, and then they insisted, the authorities, on a rabbi, you didn't have rabbis. What you had, chief rabbis, that is, what you had were dayanim. And there was lots of dayanim. And some dayanim were considered greater than others. So for instance, this individual, where is he? Shlomo Cohen. This is, as it says, he's a Rav. It says in the Wikipedia here, Rav of Moritz Tzedek Rashi, like the head Moritz Tzedek. He was regarded as the leading Dayan. I don't know if officially he was the leading Dayan. It's like Rav Chaim Ozer was considered the leading Rav. But there, as far as I know, there's never anything official that his Beis Din was the most important Beis Din. So this is Rav, if you look in the back of the Gemaras, you have the Cheshek Shlomo. That's Rav Shlomo Cohen. It's famous because when Herzl came to Vilna, Rav Shlomo Cohen, as the senior eldest rabbi, he greets him. And according to one version repeated by Rav Chaim Weinberg, he actually gives him a small Sefer Torah and says, with this, you will bring us back to Eretz Yisrael. So of course the Zionists always quote this, and the non-Zionists, the Agudistin, they always say, well, things like, you know, Rav Shlomo Cohen, he sees Herzl with the beard and with the top hat. He looks at him, he looks like a firm Jew. So that's why he gave him all the kavod. But since I mentioned Rav Shlomo Cohen and the great, the great Dayan he was, let me tell you two stories about him and then we'll begin. He's not going to appear in our stories because he dies a little too young to be part of it, but his successors definitely are part of it. So since we just finished with Purim, let me tell you something about Purim from the great Rav Shlomo Cohen. And then I'll tell you something also of interest. So he wrote a sefer called Binyan Shlomo. And in the sefer, he says something like, Maybe like any good Vilna rabbi should, which sounds very Haskalah oriented, very Maskilic, because look, these rabbis were connected to the Maskilim, but it's the sort of thing I'm going to tell you now that if you would tell your Rebbe in Yeshiva, he'd say, ah, that's a Haskalah Perush, we can't say that. Then you'd say, well, where Shlomo Cohen says it, then it's kosher. The fact is that a lot of the Perushim or the Maskilim are fine Perushim, even from the most orthodox standpoint. The thing about the Maskilim is that they only do Maskilim Perushim. It's not like they, sort of, Shlomo Cohen does all sorts of Lundis, and occasionally he does Haskalah like Perush. So what am I referring to, though? And I don't even know if it's Haskalah like Perush, but some people might think so. If you look in his Sefer, Siman Nunches, page Samach Gimel, in the Binyan Shlomo, he argues that in the days of the Mishnah, they did not read the Megillah at night. There was no such takana. He says this only comes later in the days of the Amora, Rabbi Shua ben Levi, was the 3rd century. And that's what he argues. And this is the sort of thing like Yaakov Reifman or Matisyahu Strasser. They would, you'd expect to see that in their writings, not in the great Dayan of Vilna. And some people might look at it and say, this isn't even Orthodox. What are you talking about? But he says, nowhere in the Mishnah does it mention at night. It mentions during the day. You can read it on your own. You can check it out in the Binyan Shlomo. But if you're just going to look in the Binyan Shlomo and you want to, or if you're picking up the Binyan Shlomo and you want to check out the thing on Megillah, I recommend check out the introduction, Dr. Mashniach, because he tells the following story. About his brother. His brother was also a Dayan in Vilna, Reb Betzalel. His stuff is also found as his Chiddushim in the back of the Gemara. And he tells the following story. That first of all, his brother was an unbelievable Eloi. Even though we think of Rosh Shlomo as the greater Eloi, he says his brother was a greater Eloi. And when he was 11 years old, he was Bucky in Shas and 2 Sedarim of Shas, in Moed and Nushim. I mean, today they might tell you when he was 11, he knew all of Shas. But okay, he tells you he knew 2 orders of Shas in Eon, and people wanted to marry him. That is, they rich people wanted him for his daughter. So his father was forced to marry his brother when he was 11 years old, 2 years before he's 13 years old. He was forced to. And then he says his father gave an interesting pshat. You know, what do we say when you have a child? We're going to raise him up to, what do we say? Torah, chuppah, and masim, masim tovim, right? So what does chuppah go before masim tovim? Masim tovim comes when you're 13. Then all of a sudden your mitzvahs count. I mean, we would say Masim Tovim before that, but he says Masim Tovim is when you're 13, everything counts. How could Chuppah come before Masim Tovim? Chuppah's at 18, supposed to be at least, according to Chazal, right? So he says that his father, when he married his son, his brother, his father's other son, Shlomo's brother, 11, he says, this is the pshat, that you have a son who's so learned that you have to marry him even before he's 13. Because, that's when the shidduch is going to be. He says, "Al yedei shi'agadleu l'torah v'yischakem harbei b'torah v'chochma m'melo yeachuba kodem amasim tovim mishum." He says because yirbu alav kovtsim harbei. Everyone's going to want to marry him, so you got to marry him off before. But it's here we're talking the 19th century. Early part of the 19th century, being married at 11 years old for the boy. Girl, it's one thing. Okay, my friends, let us pick up all the good stuff we got to do today. And we're back in Slutsk, and I think, you know, Paul mentioned last class about Refresco Abramsky, and I said I thought he was the grandson-in-law of the Ridbaz, and indeed he is. The last thing we mentioned was I said that we're going to remember Meir Feimer, and we're going to see his open letter in just a minute. The suggestion was that the Ridbaz brought in the Slobodka Bochrim to strengthen his position in the city against the challenge of Rameir Feimer's followers. Now, Kamenetsky, Making of a Gadol, page 488, he challenges this because he says, if you look already years later when the Ridbaz was in Chicago, He writes an introduction there. He talks about a fascinating introduction all about the situation of Jews in America. And he stresses the theme of education. In fact, he even says, look at the Poles. When they come, they open up their own schools, Catholic schools. He says, we need to do this. This was an era before Jewish state schools. So Kamenetsky wants to give us an example of that. He was, the Ridbaz always had a stress on Jewish education. Okay. Maybe, maybe not. It's not clear to me. But, be that as it may, Rav Meir Feimer saw a challenge in this. And I want to show you now, something. The opening salvo in the Musar dispute. That is, when I say the Musar dispute, I mean the, not just like you had criticism years before, Yisrael Salanter sign, but what begins the whole feud, which continues 10 years really, going strong in the yeshiva world. And then it became more an intellectual. So when we talk to Chazon Ish's criticism, he's not really part of the Musar dispute or Rav Kook. That's just criticism, but an active dispute going on. And it begins with an open letter that Rav Meir Feimer writes and publishes it in this newspaper, Hamelitz. As you can see it here, it was a daily in Adar in March of Adar Sheni of 1897. So first you might want to ask yourself, this is Haskalah newspaper, Hamelitz. It deals also with Inyanei Medina, Umada. What's he doing writing in a Haskalah newspaper? Well, there's lots of Rabbanim used to write in Hamelitz. Remember, the Russian Rabbanim, the Lithuanian Rabbanim, the distinction between Maskilim and Orthodox wasn't so clear. Many of the Rabbanim had half a foot in the door of Haskalah. Many of the Maskilim were big Talmidei Chachamim. It's not like the boundaries in Germany or Galicia. They were very much connected. Now, you had people who were sort of out of the fold who would write, like if Yalag wants to, Yehuda Leib Gordon wants to write something, Hamelitz would publish it also. Maybe it's comparable to something like the Jewish Week. It doesn't exist anymore. Or today, the Times of Israel. If a rabbi has something to say, something important, you can see him publishing it in the Times of Israel, if you would say in English, or in America, the Jewish Week. Agudas figures would write things in the Jewish Week to put their position out. Whatever we can say, maybe it feels a little strange today, but that's how they would do it in those days. And it's the lead article. But even before I get to that, I have to call your attention to something else, though. Forget about Maskilim publishing it. You know, rabbis publishing Maskilim. Look who the next article is. It begins here, El Hamotzi Lo'or. Who is it? Daniel Chvolson. So if you don't know who Daniel Chvolson is, I'm going to tell you who Daniel Chvolson is. Daniel Chvolson is the most famous Mashulman in the 19th century. He was a Talmud Chacham, given regular education, never got semicha, fortunately, but given a very good rabbinic education, and then he became expert in scientific scholarship in Arabic. He had a professoriate in St. Petersburg. He had to get that, he had to convert to get that. And he was a scholar. And he also, though, although he's an apostate, he always felt connected to the Jewish people. In fact, he famously said about himself, punning on the words of Yom Kippur liturgy, "The achshav shenotzarti ke'ilu notzarti." In Yom Kippur, it means something else. What he meant, said it is, now that I'm notzarti, I became a Christian, it's as if I'm not a Christian. In other words, he only became a Christian. The story is that they asked him, Professor Chvolson, what convinced you to convert? And he replied, I was convinced it's better to be a professor in St. Petersburg than a Muhammad in Novozibkov or substitute any other shtetl you want. So he just did it to get ahead. But he continued to remain connected to the Jewish people, and he was very important. He fought against anti-Semitism. He fought against the blood libel. He wrote numerous pieces defending the Jews, so much so that on his jubilee, I think his 70th birthday, all the rabbis sent him, got together, they wanted to send him a big, and they did send him a letter thanking him for everything he did to protect the Jewish people, Hakar Satov. But Rav Chaim Brisker refused to sign it. He said, I will not send a letter of thank you to an apostate, to a mashumad. And he, so That's replying. I don't know. Today, there was a time people would say, someone who's intermarried. You can never invite someone who's intermarried to address, a Jewish event. We obviously know today you can't keep to that because in an unorthodox world, they're all intermarried, especially politicians. You're going to say you're not going to have a politician event intermarried. So things can change. And I mean, we. If you had an era, if we had someone who was an apostate who was like a big pro-Israel supporter, can you imagine half these people, half the Jews in Congress, more than half, unfortunately, I don't need to go into the details. They are so anti, so bad for us. And I don't just mean Sanders. You got that woman in California. You got a lot of Jews. They're not our friends. So if we had a Meshulman who was actually helping Israel, I'm sure that the AIPAC would honor him and the OU might honor him. Who knows? There would be Machlokas in the OU. If Aguda, I don't know if they would, but they Shulchan and this was really pikuach nefesh in the days of pogroms to have someone like that. So, but here you see him. He writes, he's still writing for Hamelitz, even though he's an apostate. So, fascinating. Okay. So, but following that, right before that, the lead article from a Meir Feimer. Now, we live in amazing times because before the Hebrew University, before the internet, obviously, and before in Israel, the National Library put all these old Hebrew newspapers online, how would anyone find the Hamelitz? Harvard actually, when I was there, had bound copies of Hamelitz, the only place in America that has bound copies on the stacks you can go get. Everywhere else, I don't even know if in New York they have bound copies. They have microfilms. In fact, I'm pretty sure they don't in most of the places. But suffice, so if you live in Cambridge or Boston, you go to Harvard, otherwise you're in New York, you go get the microfilm. What do you do anywhere else? Today, within 1 minute, when I saw this article referred to in Dov Katz, I pulled it up within a minute. Any of you can go pull it up. You can see all the Hamelitz. It's unbelievable that what we have access to today. So I don't. I'm going to read it from you from the Pulmus of Musar, except for one little section, because this is the only example I think where Dov Katz. Remember we said that Dov Katz in the introduction says I'm going to give it to you straight. I'm not going to censor Gedolei Yisrael. We need to know the history. However, in this one case, he says, I'm going to copy it. Mila b'mila prat levitoy echad ushnayim shem harif biyoter. I'm going to leave out one or two expressions that are too sharp. Well, years ago, it would have been hard to find the newspaper. Now I found it. I'll tell you what he left out. Okay, so Rameir Feimer, in the opening salvo of the Musar dispute, what's going on here? So he says, he begins by saying, hold on, let me, yeah, he, the whole thing is copied, directly in Pomo Samusar. He begins by saying that certainly learning Musar, Sifrei Musar, occasionally, Lefrakim Krovim, often, I should say, is vital, is important. Because, our teva is, we like to, we get haughty and we get, we move apart from the way we should be. So we definitely need Musar. So then he says, we have to learn the Musar of the Kadmonim, the earlier authorities, definitely. I make a Seder, not every day, says Lifrakim. 100%. So that we can be removed from gaiva and bad midos ras. If you learn the Rambam, you're also learning it in certain sections. And that will put you on the straight path so you'll behave with God and with people. And therefore, he says, your learning of Torah and your musar will go together. He says, however, when you learn musar every day, and then he says, he says that if you learn Musar every day, and you're also learning, let's say, Masechta Bava Basra, which is different Masechta, you're not going to be under pressuring yourself. You're not going to be exerting yourself to understand the Gemara. He assumes. I don't know what the connection is. Why can't you? But this is going to get back to what, Musar, what we think of today is not what it was then. He says if you're learning every day Musar and you're learning Gemara and you're not really exerting yourself. And what are the Mefarshim you have to learn when you do Bav Basra? He says it's the Rashba and Tosos and the Rif and the Rush. And you don't learn them at all. Again, why this assumption that if you're learning Musar, you're not really learning the Rishonim. I don't know why he says, but he assumes that these people, they're not going to be serious Lamdanim because they're spending all this time learning Musar. How much time are you learning Musar? An hour a day? That still gives you plenty of time. Maybe he thinks they're learning 3 hours a day. I don't know. There are people who are learning 3 hours a day, not the average. He says, you need to know the Rishonim to know how to decide halacha. Because that's what the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah are based on. And then you need, when you study the Shulchan Aruch, you need to know the Nosei Kelim, he says, the Sma, the Shach, etc. You need to know all of this. And yet, he says, these people in the Musar yeshivas, you know what they do? He says, they were in Baba Basra, and instead of learning the Rishonim, and instead of learning the Kamas of Shulchan Aruch, they were in a Ketzos HaChoshen. That's what they spend their time on. Okay, where does this idea come from that they only learn Ketzos HaChoshen? Ketzos HaChoshen was actually instituted in Tells, and then from there it went to other yeshivas, were told by Eliezer Gordon. Okay, so you see, and Tells was a Musar yeshiva, although we're going to see the big dispute in Tells as well. What can I say? With all due respect to Refimer, this is a canard. It's not true. We know many Rabbanim who studied in the Musar yeshivas in Slobodka when it was a Musar yeshiva before the split, they learned Rishonim. They didn't just learn the Ketzos HaChoshen. But that's already, you see here, and this is going to be, with all due respect to these, and these are Gedol Yisrael. I mean, I don't touch their fingernails, but in learning. But we're going to see very clearly in the response from Meir Feimer, you could be the greatest Gedol in the world, but if you don't have the facts correct, you need to be corrected. If you don't have the correct facts, you need to be told what the truth is. And this idea that in the Musar yeshivas, they just spent their time learning Gemara, Musar, and Ketzos HaChoshen, or whatever other analysis like this, it's not true, but that's what he says. He says they spend their time in Ketzos HaChoshen, umafalpel devorim, pulim shel hevel. They're doing all sorts of mental gymnastics. So it's not just the Musar is a problem. The whole yeshiva curriculum is a problem for him. And they connect themselves with other students who are likewise, and that leads to basically nonsensical education. And he says, but hardly needs to be said, Eich rachok lo meitzeh min ha'emes, how far these Musar students are from Torah truth. Now he's in Sutz with them. All he had to do was walk over to the Musar yeshiva, the yeshiva that the Ridbaz established, and he could see that it's a falsehood. Maybe they do study Ketzos HaChoshen. I'm sure they did, but they did a lot more than that. But this is what he says. And he says, we can say about these Talmidim that they are not, their Yadayim or Aglayim are not in the Beis Medrash. Basically, they're wasting their time. Kishikar ein lo raglayim, because the falsehood has no feet, and therefore they have no feet. They are far from proper learning, and they're also far from proper learning in Musar books, which they learn every day, because they do the opposite of what the Musar books tell them to do. This is going to be a theme we're going to see as well. The idea, you figure the Musar people, they're supposed to be the highest in terms of personal characteristics, how they relate to people, and instead the argument is going to be that the Musar students become big Bali Gaiva, big haughtiness, and think that they're the only ones who have the truth. And they look around looking down on everyone else and looking down on Gedol Yisrael, who are not Musar people. And there's some truth to this, no question. I'll show you the evidence. You're in a Musar yeshiva, you look at someone, let's say in another yeshiva who doesn't study Musar, you look down on him and you look down on his Rebbe. Why do you look down on his Rebbe? You look down on Rabbi Baruch Bar Leibowitz, for instance. Why? Because you've been indoctrinated. If you're in a Musar yeshiva, you've been indoctrinated that unless you learn Musar, you can't be a complete Jew. So here you see these people don't learn Musar, and you're also told that even the Rosh Yeshiva need to learn Musar. So it is going to lead to some of this feeling, how to, you know, walk the middle path. That's going to be something the Musar people are going to have to learn to do. But there is some truth, Rameir Feimer is saying, that it did create a sense that they were an elite. And when you're an elite, you do look down on the others because they don't have the truth. But look, that's, you know, every Hasidic group, I think, has that, you know, because you're not in my group. You don't know what it means to have the real Rebbe and all of it. That's what he says here. And then he goes on. And the Ketzos HaChoshen, returning to Ketzos again, that's Aryeh Leib Heller, the famous Aryeh Leib Heller. If he was alive today, he certainly would not be learning like this, because he wouldn't just learn the Ketzos. He'd do what he did. Gemara, Rishonim, and he learned the Shulchan Aruch. And after that, he went into the his analysis, and he said he would rebuke them for what they're doing. He says, those Musar students, Hema Hashualim HaMachablim Kerem Hashem, that these are like the wily foxes. They're destroying Torah. These are harsh things. Basically, you're talking about not just Talmidei Chachamim, the ones in Slutsk. We're talking about the greatest of the Slovakia students. And this is what you say about them. He says, Uvalis Safek Einam Yodim Shum Din Aburyo. Af Michael Choshen Mishpat. Yes, they don't even know one halacha properly, even Choshen Mishpat, where supposedly they're spending their whole time studying Bav Basra. I mean, again, this is Motzi Shem Ra. You can see why the response is going to be so harsh, because I hate to say it, but what he's saying is false. And you can imagine you're in Slutsk and you're studying there and you read this about yourself. How are you supposed to react? On the one hand, you're supposed to have kavod for gedolim. On the other hand, when the gadol is saying something which is false about you, totally improper, and it's a libel, are you allowed to defend yourself? If you defend yourself and you say the truth, and the gadol, if Meir Feinberg was a gadol, he looks bad because you're embarrassing him probably by showing they didn't have the facts. And that's always been an issue. There'll be many examples in Jewish history where people refuse to respond to gadolim because they don't want to embarrass the gadol by pointing out his flaws. So the Rambam says, you know, you can be now loving, venom, olvin. But there's, as far as I know, there's no obligation to do that. If someone could be a gadol, but if he says something about you that's false, you can certainly defend yourself. But he goes on, and he says, he continues, and then he says, he returns. He says, if you study Musar, that's good to study by yourself, and to do it for the sake of God. However, if you do it in public, that is, you do it with a group, where you have a whole seder, where someone bangs on the table and says, for the next hour, now you're all together going to be learning Musar. He says, and if you do it, lefarsei matzmo, kirei shamayimu, you do it to let people know that you're special, you're working on yourself so you can be Yirei Shamayim. That's not something private. It's not something just between you and God. You want the whole world to know about it. Then he says, this is clearly an example of hypocrisy. He says, because the whole point of your learning is just to deceive people, so that they think, just like the Tosas mentions, you have these Ramayim, you know, these deceivers who would put on tefillin to fool people, to think that they wear it. And he says, Hamisasim Yachad Bagura Haris Kihema Hatzadikim Shabador. He says, these people get together and they do their Musar thing because they want to show we're the Tzadikim. We're the only ones who have the proper path. It depends how seriously you take the language of the Musar people. The Musar people did say you need to do this, and if you don't do this, you're missing an important part of Torah learning. So if you're not in the Musar school and they said, well, you're missing a part of Torah learning, well, then you might think, well, then they're saying that we're not really learning Torah. But, you know, sometimes people say things like that just to build themselves up. They don't actually mean that others are defective. Fine, others they're not learning Musar. It would be better if they did. It depends how seriously you take the language. But he takes it seriously, and he attacks them. He says that. But then he says, but when it comes to the Bacharim, they're not so guilty. Why? They don't know. They're young. Rather, they have been brought to this. They have been, you know, they have been led astray by those who've captured them in their nets, by the manalim, that is, the people who run the yeshivas, the Alter Sabatka, that's what he's referring to, and others. The Hema Atidim Litenes Adin Asher Hem Atshodim Nefashos Alechem Bato. Well, you know, these people, the people running the Musar movement, they're the ones who God will call them to account, because they're creating all these problems. A kavanasam, what's their intention? Money. They're doing it all to give themselves money. That's what it's all about, he thinks, because they collect a lot of money for their mussar. They claim when they go out, we have a new style yeshiva. It's a mussar yeshiva, and we're teaching people things that giving them an approach to learning that the other yeshivas are not doing. So he's saying, Meir Feinstein is saying, it's Gezel Gomor. They're doing this to support themselves economically. That's what they're doing. And he says that they try to show how they're learning in this way to fool people. Now what? And then he has v'chule. What he doesn't include are the words v'tamei or tamei yikra. That basically we should call them tamei. That they it's a pasuk from Chumash he's taking. He says hatzavuim shebesutzk, the hypocrites in Sutzk, they made a contract in Matsruim Shabbat. So you have the hypocrites here, the phonies in Slutsk, who made a contract with the phonies in Sabatka, and they joined together. Oy Lador Shakachal, woe to our generation that this happened. So I mean, you can't get any harsher than this. I mean, it would be one thing if you'd have a little critique that I don't think this is the proper path or this. This is a full-blown, nuclear attack, throwing everything out there, attacking not just the actions, but the motives. It's all about pride, not just for the students, but for the gedolim, mussar, that it's all about, money. They want to get rich, and they're using this whole thing, idea of mussar to bring money into it. And the whole thing's a fraud, and the students aren't learning. I mean, this, as you can imagine, this created a shockwave. The lack of kavod of the Rosh Yeshiva and of the Rabbanim and the Talmidim. And on this page, in Pumos HaMusar, Dov Katz tells the following story, and he tells it in the name of Hayashish, the elderly, Rav David Rachman, who was present at the time as he was a student in the Slutsk Yeshiva. Who's David Rachman? David Rachman is none other than Emanuel Rachman's father. He's the author of this sefer, Kiryas Chana David. It happens to be a really interesting sefer because he has Sheilos HaTshuvos and letters with lots of different gedolim back and forth. Quite fascinating. And at the bottom, you can see there's a kuntres by his son, Harav Dr. Menachem M. Rachman, who was the rabbi of Shari Tefillin for Rockaway. When Rachman was young, he also was a Lamdan, and he's able to write Chidushim. So it says he's a Yad Yamin, not just a rabbi of Shari Tefillah, Yad Yamino, the right-hand man. He was assistant to the Nasi of Yeshiva Reb Zochanan, who was that? Dr. Belkin. So an interesting sefer, and Rabbi Rachman, he comes to America. There's David Rachman. He was Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva Reb Zochanan, and then he didn't want to take Parnassa from the yeshiva, so he moved. He becomes an insurance agent. He moves to Albany. That's where Emanuel Rachman's born. And the story I'm going to tell you now is about Rabbi Yosef Konvitz, and it comes from Rabbi David Rachman. All the Gedolim were very close to Rabbi David Rachman. With his son, they saw his son as someone who fell far from the father's, the branch tree of the father. Yosef Konvitz actually made the shidduch of Rabbi Rachman, Rabbi David Rachman. He tells the whole story in the introduction to the sefer. So what does he say on this page? Here they're in Slutsk, and obviously when this letter went out, it was clearly the talk of the town. So he tells the following story that in the big shul in Slutsk, that's not the shul that Rabbi Feinberg went to, it's the Ritva's shul, one of the leading students of the Slutsk yeshiva, Rav Yosef Konvitz, he would later become the son-in-law of the Ritva's, and he would later become one of the big rabbanim in America. He was first in Slutsk, and then I mean, Slovakia, then in Slutsk. He stood up and he says he rejected all of the claims, the critiques, the more than that, the hashamot, the blames of Rav Meir, and he expressed wonder that Rabbi Feimer could attack the Musa yeshivas so much without ever having visited them. He has no idea what's happening inside the Moshe Yeshivas, and yet he doesn't just attack them, he makes a public letter. Hey, we've had lots of examples subsequently where people say things they don't know what they're talking about, even great rabbis. But this is what he says. And he says, at the beginning of his defense of the yeshivas and his response, his rejoinder to Rabbi Feimer, he justified himself. And he says, don't think that what I'm going to do now is chutzpah against one of the Gedolim, Kapei Gavra Rabba. And remember, he's going to get up and show that everything Rameir Feimer says is without foundation. Rameir Feimer is not going to end up looking so good after this. He says, Yosef Konvitz said before he did this, don't think that this is a lack of chutzpah. He says, because here we're dealing with a lack of knowledge, chosor yedia. And he says, in such a case, even a katan can tell into the ears of a gadol. That is, even me, Yosef Konvitz, a young yeshiva bacher, can say to the gadol, Rav Meir Feimer, that you're wrong, because we're dealing with facts. And he says, how do we know this? Yitzias Mitzrayim, Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim tells us. Every father, right? Even if the father is not a chacham, he's obligated, we know, L'saper b'Yitzias Mitzrayim. He's obligated to tell the story of Yitzias Mitzrayim to his son. Even if the son's a chacham, we know there's four sons. One of them's a chacham. So wait a second, if the son's a chacham, why doesn't the son tell the story to the father? But no, the father's supposed to still tell the story to the son. Why? Because this isn't lumnus. This is mesiras uvdos. This is facts. This is history. So you don't need to be a lumnus. The father, who doesn't know any Torah, but he knows enough at least to know the story, it's his job to tell it. And therefore, Yosef Konvitz says, when you're dealing with reality, with facts, there's no gadol and there's no katan. There's who has the facts and who doesn't. Rameir Feimer, yes, and gadol in learning. Certainly, I'm not going to challenge him in learning and anything. He knows a lot more than me in terms of learning. But here we're dealing with the facts. And therefore, even though I'm a katan and he's a gadol, I have the facts and he doesn't. I think it's a very important Musar Haskil. I mean, sometimes you have big rabbis who say things and just completely wrong because they don't know the facts. So then you try to point out the truth and people say, who are you to point it out? What do you mean, who? That's the answer is, when you're not dealing with lumdus, you're not dealing with psak, you're dealing with reality. Did it happen? Did it not? Factual things. I don't need to be a gadol of learning. If I have the facts, then in this case, I have the truth. And he can know Shas backwards and forwards. He can get the Rogachover. But if he doesn't have the facts, then it doesn't matter. So in this case, I have to say Rameir Feimer didn't have the facts. So that's the response. Now, even with the dispute, well, he goes on, by the way. I'll read it to you later when we get to his response. But even with his dispute with the Ridbaz, it does seem that this is over the top. I mean, it could, but he doesn't apologize. Not only doesn't he apologize, he digs in and he finds support. In fact, once Rav Meir Feimer, you know, the old story that the one hot bath, the one who say about Amalek, you know, they were the ones to jump in the hot water. It cooled it off for everyone else. Once Rav Meir Feimer launched the attack, then everyone else felt comfortable in joining in. And the second rabbi to join him very shortly afterwards, and you can follow this in Hamelitz. Hamelitz becomes the back and forth of these arguments, was a rabbi, his name, totally unknown today, but in his day, he was one of the Gedolei Yisrael. Hopefully, as we go through these courses, you'll learn about Rabbanim, who in their time were Gedolei Yisrael. And they've been forgotten because only very few in each century, very few rabbis live on. The reality is, you know, one generation passes, a new generation arises. Yiftach Gedora, Reik, Shmuel Gedora. Every generation has new rabbis. It's very rare for people to be remembered, to continue. I know one example, however, where the rabbi was totally forgotten and then was resurrected, as it were, the Minchas Chinuch. Minchas Chinuch in his lifetime was not considered one of the leading figures, and after his passing, wouldn't have been really remembered. But then he's rediscovered, as it were, because of his sefer. That's very unusual, though. But it's also very unusual. I think it's like Kierkegaard. If I'm not mistaken, Kierkegaard, years after his death, he had to be rediscovered. I think it's it's also, that's almost unheard of, but it's also very unusual that 100 years is, who do we learn from the 18th century? Who do we learn from the 19th century? Very limited curriculum. That doesn't mean that the people we learn are greater than the others. For whatever reason, they had a position. Now, kol toi b'mazal fi sefer Torah shebeichel, the Zohar says. You had a position. If Rabbi Yitzchak Ochanan didn't have a position in Kovno, if he had a position in some out of the way little shtetl, maybe he wouldn't have written his Sfarim because they wouldn't have asked him questions. There's all sorts of reasons why things happen. But this rabbi, he was a rav in a city called Zager. His name is Chaim Tzihirsch Broida. Katz in Pumos Amusa refers to him as Tzihirsch Broida. But that's not his name. His name is Chaim Tzihirsch Broida. And it confused me a lot when I first saw this, because there are two rabbanim, at least I know, there's probably more, named Tzihirsch Broida. One of them was the rav in of Salant in the city, and he's a Rebbe of a Rishro Salanter and also of a Zundel Salant. So I'm thinking, who is this? Wait, what's going on here? After he was the Rebbe, he turned on? I couldn't understand what's going on. But it's not him at all. And second, there's another Tzihirsch Broida, Broida. Let me see how it's, how he writes it at least. I wonder if all the Brodies and Brodas today are descended. Bet Resh Vav Yud Dalet Broida. The other is the son-in-law of the Altar of Kelm and a Musar figure in his own right. He ran the Talmud Torah in Kelm, which we'll speak about because the Talmud Torah in Kelm also becomes part of our story. I'm referring to another person. His name is Rav Chaim Tzihirsch Broida. He's the father-in-law of a Rav named Rav Zell Reuven Benges. Maybe the name means something to you. Rav Zell Reuven Benges, a Gaon Shebegaonim from Volozhin, very, very close friend of Rav Kook. In fact, one of the famous stories we have of Rav Kook from Volozhin is every day Rav Kook would look at this little piece of paper and then put it away and during davening. And Rav Zell Reuven Benges was wondering, what's he doing during davening? Checking the stock market, whatever he's doing. It's like today you'd see people with a cell phone or something. So he put it in his little shtender. Benges went over and looked at it one day, and it said, Shivisi Hashem Onegdi Tamid. That is, throughout the davening, Rav Kook would take out this piece of paper, Shivisi Hashem Onegdi Tamid. And the thing is, though, Rav Benges, although he's a Lithuanian rabbi, he becomes the head of the Eda Charedis, or one of the two heads. They have the Rosh HaBeis and the Av Beis Din. He refused to take this position when Rav Kook was alive. But he took it, which means he became a bit of a kanoi, but it was not personal. He corresponded with Rav Kook and was very close to Rav Kook, and but whatever. So he had a more separatist position. So this Rav Tzihirsch Broida is the father-in-law of Rav Zell Reuven Benges. I happen to have picked up, when you hear the Megillah, you're not supposed to bring a Megillah. Maybe there's a heter. I don't know a heter. You're not supposed to bring a Megillah with commentaries to shul. Shouldn't even have a Megillah, I don't think, with Rashi, because your eyes could start looking down, and the next thing you know, you missed the words, you weren't paying attention. It's a problem. However, Shir HaShirim, I never heard that there's halacha. You have to say Shir HaShirim, and that you have to hear every word. So I like to have commentaries for Koheles, for Shir HaShirim. They're long. It takes a long time sometimes. So I try every year to bring a different commentary. So a few years ago, or more than a few actually, probably 15 years ago, I picked up something. It's called Shir Chadash, Shlosha Sfarim Niftachim al Shir HaShirim. Three Sfarim on Shir HaShirim. So what are the three Sfarim? And they give a little introduction about each one. One by a rabbi named Shmuel Einstein, who was he came to America, was a rabbi in Chicago, but first that he was in Lita. Don't know anything about him. I actually haven't looked at his commentary yet. But the next one is from Harav HaGaon Chaim Dov Paltarovitz. That's what I mentioned. This is Gwyneth Paltrow's family. Her family, lots of rabbis in her family. In fact, she's the only one, she's descended from him, but she's not descended. This rabbi who I just mentioned, son Meir, he wasn't a rabbi. I think all the other sons were rabbis, including Rav Shmuel. He was a business person. He came to America, then he went to London. So she's descended from the non-rabbinic side. But she comes from real rabbinic yichus. And if you go online, there's a video of her with Glenn Diner. He's a professor at Sarah Lawrence, an expert in Hasidus. He wrote a whole book also on Jews and whatever, taverns. He's really into social history. So it's him and her, and he's explaining to her all about her forefathers. So that's Gwyneth Paltrow. But then you have the third. It's called Shir Chodesh, or Shir HaShirim, by Rav Chaim Tzvi Hirsch Broide. He wrote a number of Sfarim, Lundish Sfarim, and this is actually published in America. And you know who put it out? Put it out by a rabbi named Gedalia Dov Silverstone. Gedalia Dov Silverstone was the rabbi in Washington, D.C. for like 50 years. He wrote probably 30 Sfarim, but they're all Sfarim in Drush, Agada, Perishan, like Pirkei Avos. I just assume, maybe I'm assuming incorrectly, that he's a good speaker, has good agadic ideas, but of all those Sfarim, none of them are halacha. Okay, he's not at that level. Could be a very fine rabbi. We're not dealing with the level of Tzvi Hirsch Broide. But he published it, and nice commentary on Shir HaShirim. Interestingly, in the introduction, he says he got this from Zelgruvein Begus's son. That's the family. They sent it to him for him to publish. Because he's also related. His uncle is with Tzvi Hirsch Broide. So he says, I published this for him. He says, which is a great sefer. He says, even though in this sefer he writes negative Hatzionus, he writes against Zionism. Asher ein dati maskim with dvarim harbi, Bishop Sifuze says, even though I don't agree with a lot in the sefer because he writes against Zionism, nevertheless, my uncle, I'm going to publish it. Good stuff. So the second major figure to enter the fray is going to be Tzvi Hirsch Broide. Again, a figure not really known today, but he wrote important Sfarim on real Lundus stuff, on Halacha, with Tzvi Hirsch Broide. So we will pick up with him when we get back, and next class, and that's going to lead us into Slabodka and the dispute, the feud, the split of the Slabodka Yeshiva, and then it starts getting really, really insane, let's say. And Meir Feimer's response. Of course, as you can imagine, people wrote to Meir Feimer, how could you speak this way about, these pure holy Bochrim and, Rosh Yeshiva? So we will see what Meir Feimer says. So let me take some questions and comments. Before you came on, Rabbi Kelman, I said, you spoke about the Rav as the importance of Chazaras HaShatz. He doesn't have the notion that we have, most people, that we just do it for the people. We started doing it for people who had to be Yotzei, and now we don't, but we continue it. So for the Rav, there's a real kiyum. So yes, we don't correct people who make a mistake in Chazaras HaShatz. Even if someone skips a word, we don't correct them. It keeps going. I wonder if the Rav held you have to correct someone. If he skipped a word, certainly, but even if he mispronounced a word, changes the meaning, we don't correct. But I wonder if the Rav held that Zakiyum, so you have to. I wouldn't be surprised if he did. Maybe
Personally,
someone.
for sure would. I can't imagine he wouldn't.
And you know what? Someone privately sends to me that in Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's Bris Yeshiva, they correct for mistakes in Chazaras HaShatz. So that's obviously a tradition. Yeah.
Rav Chaim used to correct for the mistakes on Trump and Laning.
Yeah, the Rav also. Yeah.
Instead of Amerchat Tivchat, they'd go and correct you.
But you can make a claim that that's, at least from us, that's more important than Chazaras HaShatz, that it has to be done properly. But they think it's a kiyum because for us, yeah, Chazaras, there is a Hector, by the way. It's not just a modern thing. The Manig, as I recall, Renachum Rabinovich is big for saying you don't correct the Bar Mitzvah boy. I think it's the Manig says you don't correct anyone because it's a busha for
Rav
him.
Soloveitchik, I think, also held like that. He would never correct the Bar Mitzvah boy. What he would do, from what I recall, what he would do is he would quietly lane again after the Kiddush. He'd get 10 people. In other words, he doesn't think he was Yotze. No, it's a beautiful. He didn't want to embarrass the Bar Mitzvah boy. I think it's awful when people yell at the back. It's the Gabbai's job. And when people yell at the back with Bakur, it's terrible.
And that's pretty much falling out of style. My growing up, that was like a sport. If you could catch it and call it out. But today, at most shows I'm in, they leave it to the people on the side, the two gabbayim, don't catch it, then you can. But people don't
No, even if
generally
the
leave it.
Gabbai miss it, even if I miss it, I know a friend of mine who's a rabbi. He says if any Gabbai miss it, go to him. Being Gavra LaGavra, and he'll decide if you have to go back and read it again. Embarrassing somebody is a lot worse, and you're going to tell me you should have prepared better. You know, it's
well,
whatever.
You know what? In my son's the guy at the Michigan Minion, University of Michigan, and there they don't really prepare. They don't, you know, so then they actually correct during
They have the
McGillis
hand
Esker, which
signals,
is
you know.
unusual. So they're
Yeah, okay,
correcting it.
that's another. Okay.
Jacob, thank you. I did not know that, Drew. I knew it and I forgot it, that Al-Ghazi was the publisher of Chemdas Yamim. Chemdas Yamim is a very important Sephardic text. It's very beautiful in many respects. Well, it's appears to be clear Sabbatean work, whether it was written by Nathan of Gaza or not. Notice I say Nathan of Gaza, because Jews lived in Gaza also. I did not know that he published it. But even if it is written and is it's clear Sabbatean elements, it's a dispute, but it seems to have it. It still has many beautiful things in it. And Ruth, the small ground stone is put at the foot of the individual grave. Yeah, the problem is I don't know which side is the foot there, because I guess I'm looking at the not the foot, because you wouldn't have Hebrew on that side, I guess. When I went to Omaha, it was Rabbi Gross. He's not the rabbi anymore. He says, I'm going to take you. He didn't tell me where even at first. He says, I'm going to take you to somewhere where I'm sure you want to go. And I'm thinking, Omaha, I don't know where I want to go. Omaha, Mutual of Omaha, like the insurance company. That's all I know about Omaha. But he took me to, I knew Rav Chaim Moshe Grzynski, but I just never thought going to his kever. There might be other rabbanim in his kever buried there too, that cemetery. Frankel says the rabbinical election and other stuff are well covered in Israel Cohen's Vilna, JPS publication 40s. Yes. And in Hebrew, you have it in the book, his name escapes me, Klausner's book on Vilna. But now we have two nice articles by Professor Gershon Bacon from Bar-Ilan University. One, the one they really repeat on the articles, but I am going to point out something. Actually, I forgot to mention it. He repeats a good deal, but one of them is focused on three rabbinic controversies. What he points out in one of the articles is this gets back to the thing I told you about David Lichtenstein, about the irreligious. He's saying 95% were irreligious. Well, if you look in 1928, the election results for the, it shows you the division of the Jewish community to the election of the council of 25 council seats. Six, the Orthodox had six of them. That is, you had Aguda Mizrahi, and then you had Achdus. Achdus was another Orthodox party organization. In fact, the one of the leaders of Achdus was a rabbi, his name was Yudalev Graubert. The Chavoy ben Imin. He made the Erev in Toronto. What a real good old Israel. But he's a Mizrahi guy, an Achdus guy. They don't know, they don't talk about that today. But he was completely Mizrahi. The economic groups, so what he calls the artisans, the merchants, you know, the different parties, they won a total of 10 of the 25 council seats. So the fact is that you'd have a number of Orthodox people who would vote for those as well. If you're a lower, you know, if you're a working class type of Orthodox Jew, I could see you voting for that also. But so you got to figure that 7, maybe 8 of the 24 seats. So you're talking between a quarter and a third were Orthodox, because I'm assuming no non-Orthodox are voting for the Orthodox parties. So yes, is Vilna dominated by the non-Orthodox? 100%, but is it 95%? No, you're talking 2/3 to 3/4. And Vilna's the big city. Remember, in the small towns, they were much more traditional than that. So I'm going to do a blog post on this. Look, I've had a blog post waiting to go up now for weeks and weeks and weeks, and I have two more ready to roll. I haven't written this one. I'm going to give you the statistics and make the case as best I can, as divisions between Orthodox and non-Orthodox demographics, both in Lithuania and also in Poland. We have unbelievable statistics from Warsaw in the 30s of how many people were not eating non-kosher. It'll blow you away, because we like to think of Warsaw as like a very religious city. So anyone wants, I can send you. I said last class I'd send the Kamenetsky book. A lot of takers. If you want the Gershon Bacon material, I can send that also. Barry says, Rabbi Barry, if you recall correctly, He read that Rav Tzviyosh Krasinski wrote a sefer on every Masechta and Shas, which had not been published. His son was dean of Creighton Medical School in Omaha. I didn't know about his son as dean of Creighton. Creighton's a Jesuit university, one of the sister schools of mine. He wrote a lot of Svarim, and a lot has not been published. They have the manuscripts. He published, he wrote a book on Sefer Torah, a number of others, but they have lots of manuscripts. Look, he was a Gadol Shel B'Gdoilim in Omaha, of all places, because he came, and that's where he had Parnassa. Nissen says, does the Binyan Shlomo consider Rav Shlomo ben Levi to be an Amora or a Tana? Well, he considers him to be an Amora. He says explicitly that... am I missing something here? Are there people who consider him to be a Tana?
Yeah, I think it's the Iyun Yaakov, the last one in Shas. I saw it in the Iyun Yaakov, that Rav Shlomo ben Levi... The Tana. There is such a position. I know it sounds.
He's a transitional figure. Rav Shlomo ben Levi is one of the transitional.
He's
people.
What? He's the end of the. He's what end of the.
The
he's
sort of
the beginning
end
of the third century, right?
Right. Now, but reading the Megillah at night is never mentioned in the Mishnah. That Kiddush of that right. Set of words. It's never mentioned.
Practically, only Rav and Rav Chi are the transitional, and Rav Shlomo ben Levi is. But there is such a position. Okay.
Well, he says his lashon is explicit. He says as follows. I got to find my paper here. Yes. So listen to his lashon. He says, "Tibizman haMishnah adayin lo haya hatakana likros haMegil gam b'layla tohab haMegil lo huskar rak yomim v'rak bi tibi mei Rav Shlomo ben Levi hiskinu shiukorin gam b'layla." So that's what he says, and you know that in the minhag in Meknes in Morocco was for the women to only read the Megillah at night for them. During the day, they didn't read the Megillah. It's nothing to do with this. It's just interesting. Jacob Sasson, last week, Ramazuz used Rav Shlomo Cohen to rule that soldiers in Gaza need not read at night and need not read before sunset. Yes, that was a big question. I saw Rav Mazuz quoted that. I learned of this Rav Shlomo Cohen from Rav Mazuz, but not last week. He quoted that. He quotes it almost every year or many times around Purim time. He will quote that. So look, at the end of the day, the argument is that at nighttime, it's of a lesser... Look, during the daytime, it was metakin by Nevi'im, you know, but this is of a lesser significance. Rav Mazuz, he has these things which he finds that no one else knows about, and then he repeats it every year. So the other Binyan Shlomo, the introduction, I got that from Rav Gifter, actually quotes it in one of his letters, volumes of letters. Last week, I was zochet to something. The son of Rav Gifter, Rav Zalman Gifter, it's the son of Rav Mordechai Gifter, sent me a big matana. If any of you from Lakewood, you can tell him I thank him publicly. He sent me, I think, 8 svarim. I have one of the Milei D'Igros I had. And these are interesting because Rav Gifter's letters on politics and everything. So he sent me a big, including Haggadah Shel Pesach, a giant package of 8 svarim. And I was looking through it just on Shabbos, and lo and behold, that's where I learned. So everything's on Shachar Pratis, because I knew I wanted to speak about the Morat Tzedek idea in Vilna, that they didn't have chief rabbis, the only Morat Tzedek, and the greatest Morat Tzedek, of course, is Shlomo Cohen. And I wanted to mention the Megillah thing, because it's around Purim, and it reminded me, you know, from Azuz, although I saw it before last week already, I had it to say. And then all of a sudden, on Shabbos, I read that of all the things he quotes, the introduction, to Rav Shlomo, the Binyan Shlomo, which maybe I saw, maybe I hadn't seen it. I certainly didn't remember it. So it all sort of fit together. Is that not Hashkacha Pratis? So I thank Rav Zalman Gifter. I was Zocha for him. That's why something, because I found about 40, 50 letters from his father, Rav Mordechai Gifter, to Rabbi Chaya Weinberg. And I copied them all on my phone. It took me a long time. And I sent them all to him, and they're going to appear in the next volume, Volume 9 of Milei D'Igros. So Shmuel says that you believe Scholz's quip was in response to a request from Rav Yitzhak Hanan, inspector, to intercede on behalf of the Jewish community. There was some decree there Yitzhak Hanan wanted Scholson to oppose. Rav Spector quipped that perhaps it was for this reason, oh, that he converted to ultimately help the community. And therefore, he replied that even though I was no tzarti, not I was created, I was born, I became Christian, Igor no tzarti. Oh, okay, I didn't know that. That's interesting. Thank you, Shmuel. I know the quip because, and as far as I know, he doesn't mention the story you told. There was Tzvi Hirsch Maslyansky. He was a big darshan in America, and they translated his, you can get it in English now. And he quotes that in his, in one of his, in his autobiography. He wrote an autobiography, Tzvi Hirsch Maslyansky, this big, he was known as the darshan. And he would go to different shuls in New York, and in those days, you'd have wandering darshani. They'd come, and people would, it's like in the days of the prophets. You look at the prophets, they're portrayed as people, like popular entertainers, that you go to listen to them. Why do you want to go hear Yecheskel to, rebuke you? But that's what people would do. So people in those days would go to hear Darshanim. They didn't only rebuke you, but they did. That was what people did in an era before TV. If you're Shomer Shabbos, what else are you doing? But it wasn't just on Shabbos. It was during the week also. But today, people are on their computers. They're watching TV, Netflix, all that. In those days, the big Darshan comes to town. You go listen to some Maslyansky. In his fascinating memoir, he mentions that. Rabbi Kalman says, Rav Schachter would often tell us that Egel v'Egel does not apply to historical facts. That is, what is the correct text? This is obvious, but he would point out that it's obvious. Okay, the obvious, it's forbidden Shina wants taxes. Okay, but you're right. If you have two texts, you could be the greatest Godol, but if he's using the wrong text, then if he doesn't have the facts, then... we can't really rely on it unless you have some sort of.
I think it's actually a Rashi and Ksuvis, if I'm not mistaken, to look it up. I think Rashi and Ksuvis mentions that when they're having the Amoraim are arguing what the Tana said. That happens all the time. You know what did the Tana say? You cannot say Elu v'Elu. One of them is right and one of them is wrong.
The source you're referring to, Rashi and Ksuvis stuff, Nun Zayin Omer Aleph. I remember it because knows. Nun Zayin Amad Aleph.
I thought it was on Nun Zayin, but I wasn't sure. Okay,
well, that's when you ever have an agad. Also, when they talk about historical facts, everything is Torah, but only one is historically correct. Even Ramosh in the introduction thinks that, when you want to know the pshat, we give different pshats, but one is the correct one, but they're all Torah. I think people of a more... I guess postmodern approach would say they're all correct because there is no, if you read my article on authorial intent, there is no one correct. Ah, Nissan, Rabbi Professor Glenn Diner presented his latest book. I didn't even know about this book. Although he wrote, I know the article, which maybe began the book, The Light of Learning, Hasidism in Poland on the Eve of the Holocaust. I did not know that. Glenn Diner was a student. Glenn Diner was a student of sorts of mine because I was at Brandeis, the rabbi there, when he was a student there. So, and who would have thought he would become, and then I was, for Shavuos, I spent a few years ago with him. Someone privately says, according to contemporary news accounts, where Rav Shlomo Cohen attended a reception for Herzl and spoke in his honor, the small Sefer Torah was presented by Zev Yavetz. Now, it's interesting you mention this because there's a lot of disputes. Other versions have that he just said to, he just, gave him a big bracha. The story of the Sefer Torah could be like the Rishon Salanter story, not exactly 100% correct. But the Sridi Eish mentions it. That's why I said it's reported by the Sridi Eish. But there's no question. The important thing is that he greeted Herzl as a very important personality coming to town. So again, that leads to the reply from the more Haredi elements that what do you look? You look at Herzl. He's wearing the big hat and he has the beard. He looks like a frum Jew. So what do you, I find it hard to believe that Rav Shlomo Cohen did not know the. And Samuel says he was corrected by the Rav when you were a shots for Musaf on Shul Shargon, and you said, Shinishtacha Mikdashach, and he called out, Hashlucha Mikdashach. Okay, so here we have Edut Nemana, Edus Nemana, that the Rav would actually correct.
But that's
sure. Shulman Levy is quoting the sixth chapter of Avos. The sixth chapter of Avos is, it's not Avos, really. It's the extra. But it, Kinyan Taras, is that considered Tanaitic? It's a Brisa, but, what do you say, Rabbi Kalman? You're the expert.
No, I was going to say Hashlucha Nishtacha is a machlokin. The old Siddurim, you have to have both. I think today, Koran Arts, where they all have Shanishtacha. But I think Rav Schechter once explains is a machloket, the Rambam and the Ravid. Do you hold that the Kedusha of the Beit HaMikdash is batal or not? So, in other words, if you say Hanishtalcha, means we can't bring a korban because the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and we have, that's it, the Kedusha was lost. If you say Hashlucha, means we could bring it, but just right now, we can't bring it. I remember you get a whole thing, it's not stam like what Girsa, it represents the whole machloket on the, if the Kedusha still applies. So why don't we bring korban? It's because it was destroyed? Or no, because now we can't do it. That's a fast, it's like whole different understanding of this, you know, who cares? Hashlucha, nishtalcha. So I usually, I switch. I like to say both, you know, one day yontif one day the other.
Someone privately says that Hashlucha is the minhag Frankfurt. But here we have Yoshua ben Levi is quoted in the sixth chapter of Avos, which is a braisa. So what do you say here? Well, I pulled up the Encyclopedia Judaica. First half of the third century Palestinian Amora of the transition period, as that's what the words that Rabbi Kelman used, I believe, from the Tanaim to the Amoraim. So if it's transition period, why is he an Amora? Maybe he's like the Shulchan Aruch, the Yosef Karu, he's in the middle. It, or if he's transition, he could be an Amora, a Tana of the transition period as well. But I don't know. He's regarded as an Amora, I guess, in terms of his halachic standing also, that he doesn't have the status of a Tana. But and we, it is a Braisa. The sixth parak is a Braisa, but some I, what can I tell you? He's a transition period. So since he's from the transition, if anyone can come up with anything else, Rabbi Kelman, anything about this?
Oh, there are a whole bunch of people. Ula is part of that. These people that. The Nechute, I think, I don't know if he's one of the Nechute people used to go back and forth for Rabbi Shimon Levi. I don't think he's ever quoted in the Mishnah, ever. And maybe six Perek and Pirkei Avot doesn't do it, because that's not really part of the Mishnah. It's not, the Rambam doesn't comment on it. I don't know how.
The Encyclopedia Judaica. Although in Amora, some of his sayings are attached to collections of Tanaitic sayings, and the Mishnah concludes with one of his Haggadic statements.
Oh, that's
in the world to come, the Holy One will make each righteous person inherit 3 in 10 worlds. And also, so that the where is that from? The Mishnah in the Taurus.
That's the last portion.
Also, it says in Kinyan Torah, you have his saying here. Okay, so basically, they're saying that they threw in a couple sayings of his, but he's not really
right. He's never mentioned in a regular Mishnah of Halacha. That it never comes up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you all. Thank you. That's okay, Rabbi Kelman, this was great.
Thank you. Always interesting and always, you know, good to, okay. Yes, okay. All right, tomorrow Rabbi Shulman, he wrote me, he says two more classes on Kohelet. After 26 weeks, he's in Kohelet. So if you haven't come, you're welcome to come. It'll finish next week, this week and next week. Then a regular shiurim during the week. Pretty soon we'll let you know about our Pesach Yom Iyun.
Somewhere I come in. Someone should, he should put out notes. Then we could bring them to show. I said on Koelis. We could during Koelis.
Koelis, not sure. Yeah, no, it's a very complicated. Yeah. I don't have to tell everybody. It's Koelis. Yeah. I teach. I'm in the middle of teaching. But I've listened to a few here and there. Yeah, he's very good. Rabbi Shulman's really an expert teacher in Tanakh. Yeah, who have not heard him yet. Okay. And then Wednesday, Rabbi Helfgott, Thursday, Parsha Shiur, Friday. I'm starting the Shimon Esrei this week. Anybody want to join class 123, please God, of our Siddur class, 2.5 years straight. So now we're up to Shimon Esrei this week. We'll start Hashem Sfatai Tivtachu Piyagiti Latecha.
One more thing I want to say, Rabbi Kelman, before I go. I forgot to mention this book. We all have this book at home, right? Look at the Haskamos. Rav Shlomo HaKohen of Vilna has Haskamah to the Mishnah Berurah. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Very good. Okay, everybody. Laila Tov. Hope everybody had a meaningful Purim. This year Purim, they took on very special meaning in many different ways. And, you know, but I think, listen, I think people did celebrate. It's also important, but that should be meaningful Purim. And we should have a nafak miyagon nesimcha me'ebel yontov should be true by Yamim Ahem v'zman hazeh. What can I say? We all know that. Let's hope and pray it comes true. Okay, everybody. Laila Tov. Be well. Thank you. Okay, bye-bye. Night.